Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Consonant with my aspiration to be the still point of a turning world, the usual two guests and two segments today. Ilan Pappé will talk, hopefully in the original sense of the word, about a deepening crisis in Israeli society that could lead the world to a better place. And Jennifer Berkshire will report on the horrors of the Trump administration's educational agenda. Ilan Pappé is an Israeli historian who has written extensively on his native country and historic Palestine, which includes the occupied territories as well. He taught at the University of Haifa from 1984 to 2006, but subject to the relentless hostility suffered by critics of Israel, he left for the University of Exeter in the UK. Pappé, a prolific author of both academic histories and popular works, is just out with Israel on the Brink and the Eight Revolutions That Could Lead to Decolonization and Coexistence, published by Beacon Press. As I said earlier, although the book deals with some grim material, there's still something deeply hopeful about it, that Israel's many and deepening problems could lead to a productive crisis. That's far from a certainty, of course. The sort of crisis Pappé is talking about could also lead to more violence, more hate, more exclusions. And his view of the current ceasefire is hardly a sunny one. But let's listen to Ilan Pappé describing how things could take a turn for the better over the longer term. We recorded this interview on Monday, October 13th, so any time references should be adjusted accordingly. Ilan Pappé. Before we get to your book, we have to talk about current events, the current ceasefire. It looks like Biden could have done something like what Trump did in late October 2023. The passage of time, of course, the extent of the massacre, have changed the political environment. But it does look like nothing like a U.S. president saying, stop it now. Can this hold? Does Bibi have something up his sleeve? Or is a declaration by the volatile and mercurial Trump that the war is over, is that going to stick?
No, I'm afraid not. I mean, I'm very happy that for a while people in Gaza are not under bombing, that political Palestinian prisoners have been united with the families, that the Israeli hostages are united with the families. This is all good news, and definitely Trump had a role to play there. But this is not an historical moment. This is not the beginning of a genuine peace process. This is a lull that can only develop into something much constructive if the whole attitude of the international community, and I'm talking about the political elites, not about the societies, will dramatically change in its perception. What is Israel today? What are the Israeli plans? And so on. In one sentence, I can tell you that any so-called peace plan that is based on the idea that the role of the international community is to mediate now between Israel and the Palestinians is doomed to fail. Any international intervention that understands that the Palestinians are under existential danger has a chance to create something better in the future. And I'm afraid, you know, that even the recognition of Palestine, which I welcomed, of course, by countries such as Canada, France, and Britain, still is not based on this understanding, or maybe it's a willful ignorance, I don't know, because the evidence is so clear. And therefore, yes, Netanyahu has other things up his sleeves. Let's remember, the ethnic cleansing in the West Bank has not stopped today. Israel this morning incinerated a sanitation center, and they're still occupying half of Gaza, and they're still attacking daily in Lebanon. And they are planning probably another attack on Iran. So this is not a stable Middle East. This is not the eternal peace that God knows where the president had these ideas from. It's a lull. It's what a ceasefire is all about. And a ceasefire that doesn't lead to proper solutions remains a ceasefire that cannot hold on.
And like many of these peacemaking schemes in the past, it treats the Palestinians as just ciphers. They're just passive. They're not active participants in any of this.
It's incredible, you know, I said to a Palestinian friend of mine, is if nothing had changed since 1917. In 1917, Britain promised the Zionist movement that Palestine would be a Jewish homeland without consulting the Palestinians, without asking the Palestinians, and determined their future with no negotiation with them at all. And here we are again, after the genocide in Gaza, the world that is the political leaders of the West and their allies in the South, are talking about the future of Palestine, and they are not consulting the Palestinians. They are not interested in what the Palestinians want, and they really think it's going to work. They keep forgetting that the millions of Palestinians, despite everything they have suffered, are still resilient, are still going to show resistance, and they are not only in Palestine. And we have seen in the last 2 years that the Palestinian diaspora is as active, as assertive, and as an important actor in the future of historical Palestine as those who live inside it.
Okay, before we get to the book, one more question about the general configuration of things. The structure of Israeli politics. People talk about the far right, Ben-Gavir and Smotrich and people like that, as being somewhat different. But it does seem that they're not all that different from Netanyahu, or are they that different from the majority of Israeli opinion, which has demonstrated itself to be merciless and bloodthirsty, like lots of kill them all, let God sort it out attitudes, it seems. And as long as that structure of the Israeli political system remains intact, can any serious peace be accomplished?
No, I think it's a fair analysis of the lack of any potential for dynamics of change within the Israeli Jewish society. I mean, they have their debates about what life should look like for the Jews, but they are quite united on what life should look like for the Palestinians. And therefore, I think you're absolutely right. The difference is not really fundamental. And actually, we had an incredible proof for this today when the leader of the opposition gave a speech in the Knesset today, repeating the same ideas, images of the Palestinians, dehumanization of the Palestinians, as did Netanyahu. You couldn't tell. I mean, they could have exchanged the speeches, and you wouldn't know who gave which speech. So, that is something for the international community, again, to digest and internalize the lack of any hope for change within the Israeli Jewish society towards the Palestinians, a change in that ideology and mindset that produced the genocide and producing now the ethnic cleansing in the West Bank.
Okay, despite that intransigence, or maybe because of it, you forecast a deepening crisis for Israeli society for a bunch of reasons. Let's talk about a few of those in turn. First of all, the fissures between the secular and religious population in Israel. In the early days of Zionism, the religious part was pretty minor. It was really a secular movement. And then the religious and the right wing became dominant. How serious are these fissures, and how do they threaten Israeli society over the longer term?
I think it's a very serious cleavage, a very serious, as I call it, a crack in the foundations of the building. And it goes back to this impossible idea that Judaism is nationalism. Christianity is not nationalism. Islam is not nationalism. This whole idea that you can take a faith and turn it into a civic identity did not work. At first, the secular Jews imposed their ideas of what a Jewish state is on the more traditional and religious Jews, but demographically, out of natural growth more than anything else, and particularly the messianic zeal that the occupation of the West Bank brought with it after 1967, a counter idea that Judaism actually, or a Jewish state, has to be a messianic state, a theocratic state. Not only this, a biblical state, namely a state that rebuilds the glory of the past as they understood it from what they have read in the Old Testament or from the days of the Roman rule in ancient Palestine. That kind of idea that, you're right, it was very marginal, became quite dominant. I mean, it's now, it has huge influence in the political system, in the educational system, in the army, in the secret service, in the media. The last bastion that they have to conquer is the judicial system, but they're doing quite well on that front. And therefore, it's important to understand that they also do not only perceive the Palestinian as an obstacle for this grand future, but also the secular Jews are an obstacle, unless, of course, they will subscribe to the version of Judaism that they believe in. And this is a real struggle, which I predict, I'm afraid that I know who's going to win and who's going to lose. I call this old new messianic idea that now is so dominant, I call it the state of Judea. I think the state of Judea is swallowing the state of Israel. And in fact, we don't have the official numbers, but hundreds of thousands of Israelis who would have liked the secular liberal Israel to remain intact have already left. They left with their money, they left with their families, and they left the secular community without its elite. So the odds are not boding very well for them.
Yeah, I think you say in the book that something like 500,000 left.
Yeah, yeah.
You wrote that about a year ago, so I imagine the numbers have probably increased, if anything.
Probably higher, yeah.
Now, we saw those tensions bursting in the open before October 7th, the big demonstrations against Netanyahu's war in the court system and such. There's a real anti-Netanyahu, pro-secular upsurge that disappeared with the war. Is that going to come back?
The secular ones, I don't think. I mean, if you look at it even practically at the next elections, the only person with a real chance to replace Netanyahu is Naftali Bennett, a national religious Jew who comes from the same circles as many in the state of Judea. He's much more sharp than Netanyahu and knows how to create the impression that actually he wants to be also very liberal and open-minded. But in the end of the day, he belongs to the state of Judea and not the state of Israel. And what is more important, he will be even more consensual than Netanyahu in his aggressive and ruthless policies against the Palestinians. Because the state of Israel has two challenges. One is this inability to create a solid society from within and facing the social implosion from within. But the other one is as formidable, imposing its will on not only the Palestinians, but on the Arab world by force. And so far thinking it succeeds is not really a vision for the future that holds much hope for them in that respect. And therefore, the two are blend together if you think about what Israel would look like under Bennett if, and this is a big if, you never bury Netanyahu too prematurely, if Netanyahu is going to lose the next elections. It is the kind of realization the Jews in Israel don't have, that there might be a slight majority in historical Palestine, but they're a very small minority in the Arab world. And despite of their perception of Israel as being part of Europe, almost geographically part of Europe, Israel and Palestine are very much at the heart of the Arab world, part of its problems and part of its solution. And if they are not going to reconcile with that reality, as the whites in South Africa under apartheid did not reconcile with the reality that they were in Africa, they are going to dig their own hole, I think, in the future. And the less they are willing to realize it, unfortunately, the more violent, I think, the collapse will be.
I'm speaking with the historian Ilan Pappe, author of Israel on the Brink. Now, you write about internal reasons for the increasing vulnerability of Israeli society to collapse, but there are also developments abroad. One is the increasing distance between diaspora Jews and Zionism and the growing criticism of Israel, which, you know, 10 years ago, I live in New York City, you know, and so I'm very used to American Zionism. And the change over the last decade has just been stunning. What effect is that having in Israel?
Huge effect. Those Israelis who still hope that the validity of the state is not just because of its military power or its economic material achievements, but that there is also a moral reasoning for having a Jewish state, namely that the Jews in the world would like to have a Jewish state, I don't know, as a security or insurance against another Holocaust, or because Jews, despite the fact that they live elsewhere, feel also the nationalism that they think Judaism brings with it. When this is gone, what is Israel left with? It's left probably with some Christian Zionists who will still tell them that the state of Israel is what God wanted, to a certain extent, of course. There's a point where the Jews have to convert to Christianity or be barbecued in hell, and they would be left with fascist, neo-right parties and populist leaders, and yes, cynical multinational corporation. But even, you know, the material allies of Israel, if I can call them like this, without the moral allies, right? The material allies, would they really consider a country that is involved all the time in war, in internal instability, isolated at least by societies, if not by governments, as an asset? I wonder. I think that it becomes more and more liability, even for the military industry, which of course now is Israel's best friend in the world. But even they are businesses. I wonder whether this would be a good place to invest in the future. But what the Jewish disconnection is doing is first and foremost, you know, undermining the moral validity of Zionism in its own eyes. No less important is the fact that it will force the Jews in Israel to think, who are we? If we're not part of the Jewish world, we have created here something, and they have created something. I call it the ethnocultural Jewish identity. But to my mind, as you know from my book, this is not different from other ethnocultural groups, whether these are the Maronites, the Yazidis. The mosaic of groups we have in the Eastern Mediterranean is quite impressive, and before imperialism and Zionism actually coexisted quite genuinely. So I think it can also lead to a better realization, I hope so, of course, that a Jewish community in Palestine is part of the communities of the Arab world and less part of a world religion that believes that this is the homeland of that religion.
Now, along with the increasing separation of diaspora Jews from Israel and the cause of Zionism, we've seen also internationally a massive increase in sympathy for the Palestinian cause, which also is something that would have been hard to imagine 10 years ago. What effect is that having on Israeli politics and, you know, the conflict in general?
Well, I think its impact would be long-term and not short-term, although I do believe that the recognition of Palestine by certain countries, the change in the attitude of the International Court of Justice, the International Criminal Court, I think that also was due to the pressure from below by the international solidarity movement. So there are already immediate dividends, if you want, for this. But in the long term, and that's my analysis as an historian actually looking into the future, I don't believe that one process by itself creates this huge transformation, which I wish for, and I know many, many Palestinians are wishing for, that is to have a free country from the river to the sea where everybody is equal, truly a democratic country. I don't think each one of the processes that we have discussed by now can do it by itself, but I do think they eventually, after being discrete processes, they do fuse together and become a transformative event. And I say this on the basis on analyzing similar transformations in history. So by itself, this huge and incredible international solidarity, which is also intersectional. I mean, there are many groups that before have never been in such solidarity with the Palestinians. So it's not just the number, it's also the composition of the international solidarity movement, will play its historical role in the transformation, but it will not be by itself, and cannot do it by itself. You need the other processes which I describe in the book, to my mind. And first and foremost, I think we also need an organized Palestinian liberation movement with a clear leadership, clear vision. And as you know from my book, I'm optimistic because I'm very much involved. I listen, I read, and talk to the younger Palestinian generation, and the Palestinians are one of the youngest groups in the world, that they are on the way of doing it. It doesn't seem yet. It hasn't surfaced in a clear way because Palestinians everywhere are now worried about existence and survival rather than strategy and vision for the future. But it will come. And this, I think, will also help to orientate more effectively the international solidarity movement. Hopefully, it would change some of the positions of the governments from above. And also would lead groups like the Palestinians in Israel to take more bold strategic decisions about their future, and maybe even influence the Arab world, and at least those rulers will now try to appease Israel and the United States.
The world feels very dark at the moment, and the war on Gaza was one of the reasons, principal reasons for that feeling of darkness. But your book is actually quite hopeful, and I was moved by that, and it's, you know, it's nice to find some source of hope in this world. You have a detailed analysis of the right of return, and it sounds far more practical than I ever thought it was in the past. Obviously, there are political obstacles. A de-Zionizing of the Israeli state would be a prerequisite for any kind of serious solution. But the right of return sounds fanciful, but it's actually nowhere near as fanciful as I thought before I read your book. So lay that out for us. How could the right of return be realized in practice?
I think what is very important to understand about a repatriation of any kind, a return of refugees, that actually the international community, mainly through the United Nations, but not only through the United Nations, but also through academic work, has actually laid out quite pragmatic, detailed mechanisms to deal exactly with the kind of situation that the Palestinian refugees face, namely that many of them are second and third generation of the people who were expelled. Some of them are new expellees, so to speak, after 67 and so on. Secondly, that there is a mechanism to deal with the fact that other people are either sitting in your homes or build new villages over your villages, and that there is a question of matter of proving what you had. Many people lose these kinds of documentation. All of that was dealt, and there is a famous professor of law from Brazil, Pinheiro, who I had the fortune actually to meet him for the first time this summer in Brazil. In 2005, he laid a very detailed program. And if you look at it, it's very pragmatic. Of course, it has the big concern for the refugees' welfare, but it's not ignoring the possibilities of dramatic changes in the places where the refugees came from, especially after many years. So yes, you can find a mixture of compensation, proper return, lease of property to the refugees, settling near the place you were in, finding a way of sharing the time where you are there and not being there if you wish for. The options are great, and a lot of groups have worked on how a reconstructed, returned village would look like. The famous Palestinian scholar Salman Abu Sitta has shown very detailed research in his maps that most of the people of Israel don't have to move for the refugees to return to their original homes.
Yeah, that was interesting work, because I hadn't really heard that before. There's a whole lot of space that is not occupied by
exactly
Jews in Israel. And
because the Israelis build on the fields, they didn't build on, you know, on the buildings themselves. And what is really important here is that, you know, 50 years or 70 years, we invested in a process to nowhere. Yes, we will have to invest time and thought. I just call in the book to continue this, you know, research, to show people that the issue here is ideological and an issue of will and not an issue of practicality, of possibility. And I think the more detailed this would be displayed, it would be more difficult to explain why you reject it unless you say, you know, Palestinians have no place in Palestine, which is a racist position and not a practical one.
And for these things to be accomplished, it would require the de-Zionization of the Israeli state, but also the de-Zionizing of Judaism too, right?
Yes, yes. And this is because what Zionism has become, even less of what Zionism was, it's very clearly now an ideology that sustains an apartheid state, ethnic cleansing, genocide, and so on. And therefore, it has to be replaced by a different kind of regime, which is based on democracy, human rights, and civil rights. And even there, you know, I show in the book that the transition from a place where ideology discriminates people because of who they are, not because of what they do, into a regime which respects everyone for who they are. This kind of transition is also anchored in international law. It's called transitional justice, restorative justice. In some places it didn't work too well. In other places it worked better. You can learn from the mistakes in the places it didn't work well. You can be inspired by the places where it did work well. But this is the language. These are the challenges. I'm not underestimating for 1 minute the formidable task I'm talking about here. I'm just saying, let's first of all define the task correctly. I claim that what is called the peace process, from the day it was conceived until the summit today in Cairo, is not framing the issue correctly. is not analyzing its essence, its source, and therefore everything it offered until today failed dismally because it didn't really relate to the source of the problem. Almost like a doctor who keeps dealing with the symptoms of an illness rather than with the origin or the reason, the cause for the illness.
That was historian Ilan Pepe, just out with Israel on the Brink and the Eight Revolutions That Could Lead to Decolonization and Coexistence, published by Beacon Press. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break. Some of the song I played a couple of times before in similar contexts, A State of Peace, an unusually contemplative track by Noor Jabber from 2018. Her normal fare is fervent techno. Originally from Beirut, she now lives and works in Berlin. Next, the evil, anguish-inducing thing that is the Trump administration's educational agenda. It can be summed up by a quote that Tiffany Justice, the Moms for Liberty co-founder, who is now with Heritage Action, the Heritage Foundation's political advocacy arm, gave to ProPublica. Asked what percentage of children she imagined should be in public school, she answered, "I hope zero. I hope to get to zero." To analyze all this, we're joined by a frequent Behind the News guest, Jennifer Berkshire, who is co-author, along with Jack Schneider, of The Education Wars, A Citizen's Guide and Defense Manual from the New Press. They also do a podcast on education topics, Have You Heard? Jennifer Berkshire. So it seems like the Trump administration can't decide whether they want to abolish the Department of Education or abolish public schools, or are they out to do both? What's the agenda here?
I think the confusion is actually more profound than that. And while I was getting ready to talk to you, I've been hard at work on the next episode of my podcast, Have You Heard? It's an interview with Quinn Slobodian about his new book, Hayek's Bastards. And what he's so great at is chronicling these weird coalitions that, you know, the authoritarians who want the state to crush us and the libertarians who seemingly want the state to withdraw. And that is such an apt description of what's happening right now with education, because on the one hand, if you're in a state like Louisiana or Texas, you feel the authoritarian state coming down on your schools. You post those Ten Commandments on the wall of your classroom or else.
Or have a street named after Charlie Kirk in your campus.
Exactly. Or the state seems to be doing something completely different, which is basically saying, you know what, we're done with the state project of public education, and instead, we're just going to give money directly to the parents, and whatever they decide to do with it is really up to them. I think you're absolutely right to wonder, well, what is the agenda here? Because it feels really contradictory.
Okay, so we'll start with the Department of Education, run by, and I just can't resist the cheap shot, the former wrestling exec, Linda McMahon, but she surrounded herself with a bunch of reactionary advisors, Moms for Liberty, the lead author of the Project 2025 chapter in education. What's the mission of the McMahon's Department of Education, though?
Well, I think we got a really telling signal and a really ominous one over the weekend. You and I are recording this as we enter into week two of the shutdown, and we started seeing lots of deep layoffs. They're being justified because of the shutdown, but actually your friend Russell Vogt seems to be leading the charge. And so not only did they come hard for the Department of Education, which they have been doing really repeatedly since the DOGE days, but the programs that they went at the hardest were things like special education, right? They laid off everybody who is involved in overseeing basically the federal mandate for special education. And you wonder, wow, like, are there really enough savings there to justify that kind of a hatchet job? And I think I saw you posting something on Twitter about getting rid of the morbidity and mortality report and speculating, you know, wow, I knew they were eugenicists, but this seems a bit much even for them. And you really have to view almost everything that they do through that lens, that at the end of the day, they fundamentally do not believe that the state should be playing any role in helping us reach more equal outcomes. And what would be a more perfect example of that than ensuring that kids with special needs have the right, an enforceable right, to a free and appropriate education? And it's one that really doesn't date back that far, right? You can still meet people who are around in the 70s when a school could just turn a kid away, and then that kid's prospects were completely determined based on the amount of wealth that the family had. And that's really the vision of the future that they're barreling towards now. And all those, the kinds of ghouls that are now surrounding Linda McMahon at the Department of Education, they have a very old-timey vision of how kids should be educated. And it's basically in the church, in the home, and parents should pay for it themselves.
I have not read the Project 2025 chapter on education, but what's that say?
You don't even need to read it because we're living through it right now. It's split between higher ed and public education. And so the higher ed part is basically making it harder for kids without means to attend college, right? That we've gone way too far in holding up the social engineering role of college as they would see it. And instead, we're going to limit that role. And it's no coincidence at all that this top official in the Department of Education named Lindsay Burke, who came to the Department of Ed from the Heritage Foundation, that not only did she write the education chapter in Project 2025, but she's also been making the argument that we need to limit the number of women who would go to college because all the incentives right now are encouraging them to delay their most important role, which is having children. And so when you think like, oh, wow, she's basically now one of the top handful of people in Linda McMahon's ear, that's a little creepy.
Of course, Linda McMahon and Lindsay herself, women who have substantial careers. So that's what's for them is not the same as what's for the masses.
And isn't that always the case, right?
Yeah. When you the Phyllis Schlafly problem, yeah.
Absolutely. And even, you know, like Charlie Kirk became more religious in his orientation. The campus events would often be, they would have that jarring dissonance where you would have women who were very prominent in conservative and religious circles getting up on stage and encouraging the women in the audience not to pursue careers. And what I found reassuring was that often the women in the audience were like, wait a second, this makes no sense at all.
They have not yet completely given up on the public schools. That may be their long-term goal, but they're not there yet. But they're emphasizing patriotic education and the role of the Bible. What's the curriculum ideal?
This is a really interesting and misunderstood, underappreciated moment that if you read these really influential right-wing thinkers, and I'm thinking of somebody like a Kevin Roberts, who's the chief of Heritage, or somebody like a Pete Hegseth, who, you know, before he was our Secretary of War, he was the co-author of a book called The Battle for the American Mind, where he encourages parents to take their kids out of the public schools and pursue classical Christian education. And this is really the vision of schooling that they are rallying around. And I think what's interesting is what a dramatic departure it is from the bipartisan vision of what schools are supposed to do that has held sway on both sides of the aisle for three decades now. And that is that we go to school in order to prepare for careers, right? And the best people to decide what schools should do is actually the employer, right? Because who better to decide what little Doug is going to need to know in the future than the person who's running the company now? And so what's interesting when you read these screeds by the like of a Kevin Roberts or a Pete Hegseth is that they don't believe in any of this. They think that this is the product of basically a 100-year-long conspiracy to crush the souls of kids and get them out from the religious influence of their parents. And so what's funny when you read them is that they're at once accusing the kids of being Marxists, but also of being corporate drones, and that they think that the purpose of education should be to cultivate virtue. And so I think you feel some of that in this weird hodgepodge of policies that's coming down from the federal Department of Education. And that would include things like patriotic education, for example, that they really, other than as an opportunity to beat up on public schools, they really have very little to say about test scores or STEM. Instead, they're talking about religion, they're talking about virtue, they're talking about patriotism. And I think we get a much clearer sense from them of what they don't think schools should be doing. But if your listeners are trying to get a sense of why things feel so crazy, it's because, one, they really are. But also, I think that there is conflict on the right about what the point of all this is.
I was wondering, as you're saying these things, what does the employing class, the capitalists, what do they make of this? Have they given up on the need for an educated workforce? Or are they just, like everyone else, afraid to dissent from Trump at this point?
This, too, I think is a product of that fascinating split that you wrote that amazing piece about in Jacobin a while back. We have to view this through the lens of the transformation on the right. MAGA is so suspicious of corporations. You know, corporations really, they're not viewed as necessarily the folks who should be leading the charge. You know, this turns out to be really important in education because the last really substantial push for education reform in this country during the Obama years, that would be the Common Core. And, you know, a lot of people have forgotten about the Common Core, but not if you are on the populist right, because that absolutely spurred a revolt. And, you know, it kind of gets lost in the Tea Party moment. I'm not sure people realized what a big deal it was. But if you go back and you read what these activists were saying, they were furious that corporations were leading the charge and corporations were going to be the ones determining what kids were going to learn so that then they could be ready for employment. This helped to drive the transformation in the Republican Party. And so then you end up today with this weird, you know, we've got this party that's dominated by religious folks and car dealers and liquor distributors, because you're like, wait a second, how is it that you have a situation where in Arizona, for example, that is the furthest along towards a real free market school voucher experiment? You know, when a parent goes in search of a flat earth curriculum, and the top education official in the state says, well, basically, there's nothing we can do about that. We have a real hands-off approach here. And you think, well, that's just crazy. How is this in the interest of the ruling class? And then the answer is, well, actually, the ruling class is in the throes of a dramatic transformation.
Well, at least part of it. I mean, there are contradictions within the elites. You know, but when you're saying these things, I'm thinking of Marx saying that capital can be a civilizing force. And these people are decivilizing in every respect.
I think that that's absolutely true. And I think that's a big part of the goal. That's where you really feel the influence of the libertarian part of the coalition. And so the vision of education policy that we're now seeing play out in one state after another, and it's so different from what we're used to, is that basically we're going to go back more or less 200 years. And I'm always amazed when I read all this stuff. I read endless Substacks where the libertarian folks who are driving this stuff, they're so excited because the trend of the moment is the micro school. And that's where you just pull a handful of kids together and you educate them in the barn or the garage. If you're really wealthy, the equivalent of this is what the Zuckerbergs were doing illegally at their exclusive enclave in Palo Alto. They have a high-end micro school, but the basic premise is the same, that we're going to do this thing on your own. Right now, I think we're in kind of a transition moment where the state is still picking up the tab for this stuff, not for the Zuckerbergs, obviously, but I think this is temporary and that what we're moving towards is that not only will there be the micro school that is free of any kind of regulation, but it's also going to be free of the state paying for it. You can see how this just ends up with a future that's even more radically unequal than what we're living through now.
I'm speaking with the education journalist Jennifer Berkshire.
Elites are still sending their kids to St. Paul's and Sidwell Friends, so there's a big difference in their vision for what the masses get and what the pedigreed and rich get.
That's absolutely true. And I think they really count on the fact that, especially where you and I are in the Northeast, that when people hear private school, that is exactly what they think of. They think of St. Paul. They think of the Groton School, Phillips Andover, Exeter, right? These like Hogwarts looking academies with green playing fields and lots of ivy. You know, that isn't what private school looks like for most people. And the fastest growing parts of the market are basically low end religious schools, fly by night schools that pop up in a Florida strip mall. The idea is that we don't need any regulation because the parents are going to be the regulator. And so if they're put off by the fact that not only the teachers, but even the principals of the school don't have to have any kind of license or even a college degree, well, then they can just vote with their feet and go somewhere else.
Well, it'd be elitist to think they need some credentials, you know? On a somewhat different topic, Zoran Mamdani, likely next mayor of New York City, is proposing to end the gifted and talented programs in New York City public schools. What are your thoughts on that?
I think it's, first of all, really important to point out how weird New York City is in this regard. What an outlier, that the idea that kids would be identified as gifted and talented at kindergarten level. So, you know, it matters that that's what he's talking about. I want to view this through the lens of politics, because I think that this is exactly the sort of issue where people immediately become really worked up, especially Democrats, who, for various reasons, view education as the entree to an elite college education, right? And that starts at nursery school, that starts at kindergarten. And so any suggestion that this foot in the door is going to be taken away is going to, like, it is going to inspire blowback like nothing else. But here you have Zoran running for mayor, and he's a Democratic socialist. And you think about what pulling aside this relatively small group of kids and telling them that at the age of kindergarten, right, when they're still like playing with blocks and in the sand table, and you're telling them that they are fundamentally different from all the other kindergartners. You know, it doesn't really make sense in terms of child development, but it's also so at odds with the vision that somebody like Zoran is running on. We can get into a whole discussion about the different ways that schools sort. Not all the things that schools do in terms of sorting are terrible, but I would point to this. Anything that divides kids up at that young of an age, it's really destructive. And I know, like, this is going to be a tough issue for him. Friends of mine tell me this is going to be the thing that does him in. We'll see about that. But it often seems like when we talk about this stuff, even those of us who are on the left, there's something about that vision of schooling as solely being about social mobility and letting the little geniuses thrive that then undercuts the political principles that we're out for.
Well, at the other end of the school-age spectrum, of the exam schools in New York City are also a big political issue. Bronx Science and Brooklyn Tech and Stuyvesant, which are intensely competitive as much as private schools are. And that's always a focus of controversy, whether there's enough diversity in these exam schools. But should these sorts of exam schools even exist?
You know, it's interesting. We forget now that back in 2020, when Glenn Youngkin won that upset victory for governor of Virginia, a major issue was, you know, the admissions process to get into their elite magnet school, Thomas Jefferson. It's a STEM academy, TJ. Everybody knows what it is. And so responding to the push for equity that was all the rage at that moment, and which, you know, Glenn Youngkin himself had participated in when he was still running the show at Carlisle, TJ had changed its admissions policy in order to better reflect both the race and the income reality that is the community that it's based in. And this set off such an uproar that I think a lot of people would tell you that that was a big part of why Glenn Youngkin ended up winning that race. And it tells you, like, what a third rail this thing is. And consistently, right? Like, you can go back decades and people are having the same argument about the specialized high schools in New York.
The other side of the proverbial aisle, we had Rahm Emanuel the other day in the Wall Street Journal calling for the Democrats to embrace ed reform, which is an old cliche. There are many cliches in that article. It's very impressive. Kitchen table issues, seed corn. But then there are newer model gems, like we spent the last 5 years debating pronouns without noticing that too many students can't tell you what a pronoun is. So what does Rahm Emanuel mean by reform? And more generally, where are the Dems on these issues?
Rahm Emanuel means make Rahm Emanuel relevant again. And education is an underappreciated fault line in the larger debate about where the Democrats should go, right? We've now been, what month are we in of this agonizing conversation about what went wrong and what should happen next? And so if you think about, like, well, who are the candidates out there who've got people really excited? They're the Democratic populace. So it's not just Azoran, but it's people like Graham Plattner in Maine, candidates in Iowa. There's a guy running for Senate named Nathan Sage. And one thing that I notice is that all of these folks talk about education completely differently than Rahm Emanuel. They recognize what dire threat it's under. They are in states where billionaires have basically bought their politics in order to enact sweeping voucher programs. And they're going to talk about the fact that public education is a cornerstone of democracy and the future without it looks pretty bleak. When you hear Rahm Emanuel saying the Democrats need a reset, he and his ilk are pushing back against the populist moment. You got to remember that education reform was always understood as an alternative to redistribution. What if we actually didn't have to ask anybody to give up anything? We didn't have to put kids on the school buses. We didn't have to ask the rich people to pay more. Instead, we could just have really high-performing charter schools for African American kids or Latino kids. Fast forward to the present, and that vision has lost. The bipartisan part of it is completely over. And so the Rahm Emanuels, and then you probably read David Brooks too, you know, like, he was so excited about Rahm Emanuel, and wouldn't it just be so great if the Democrats would rally around the idea of raising test scores again? Rahm is very excited about this woman who won an upset race in Iowa. Her name is Caitlin Dre, and she defeated somebody in a very red district that had gone for Trump by something like 10 points. And the irony is that, you know, she ran on a platform that's completely the opposite of what Rahm is talking about. Because Iowa is yet another state where they now have universal school vouchers on the books. People feel like this was crammed down their throats. And so the candidates who keep winning these surprise races in states like Iowa understand that. And, you know, they understand that there are Republicans who are uncomfortable with that privatized vision, too.
Yeah, I was going to say this agenda, the reform agenda, has proven very unpopular in the polls, but also in elections over the last few decades. Is this Republican agenda, the Linda McMahon agenda, going to be any more popular than its ancestors?
No, it's much less popular, which I think is one of the great ironies that people like Rahm, who are demanding that they want Democrats to run on education, but they want them to run, like rally the nation around the idea that our schools have failed and that we need to produce more STEM grads in order to compete with China. That is so tired, and it really doesn't speak to anyone. But the only vision that's less popular is that we shouldn't have public schools at all. And so I always remind people that virtually everything that the Trump administration is up to, that when you look at the polling, the least popular parts of what they're doing are always centered around schools, whether it's, you know, like sending ICE after kids, this idea that basically we're not going to have public schools. People don't, even if they don't really know what the federal Department of Education does, they're very uncomfortable with the idea that we're going to get rid of it. They sense that there's something fishy about that. To me, it's like if you're a Democrat and you're looking for something to run on and somehow you miss the part that, you know, over the weekend they eliminated the division at the Department of Ed that makes sure that your special needs kid has rights and can get an education. If you're missing that, then I can't help you.
They must know it's popular because they're doing it quickly, secretively, and with a, you know, strong authoritarian hand. So it seems like they know this, not something the masses are calling for, but they want to get it done anyway because that's just who they are.
Absolutely, and it's the same thing that you see at the state level. It's why states are so resistant to letting voters decide whether they want to go down this road of school privatization and having taxpayers pay for religious schooling. Because, you know, for like almost the last 50 years, including during the most recent election, when voters get to make that choice, they not only do they say no, but they say no overwhelmingly. So you really see politicians and their billionaire allies, all this ecosystem of school voucher groups that's been calling the shots in states like Texas and Tennessee, that, you know, when you have, often it's a bipartisan push by lawmakers to say, you know, why don't we let people vote on this? And their answer is absolutely not, because they know that the longer it's out in the light, and when you actually let people make the decision, this is the last policy route in the world that they're going to pick.
That was the education journalist Jennifer Berkshire. You can find her podcast, Have You Heard, wherever you acquire your podcasts. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out to some of a 1989 song by Lou Reed that was a perfect forecast of the Trump-Miller approach to immigrants, Dirty Boulevard. Till next week, bye.
$2,000 a month, you can believe it, man, it's true. Somewhere a landlord's laughing till he wets his pants. No one dreams of being a doctor or a lawyer or anything. They dream of dealing on the dirty boulevard. Give me your hunger, you're tired, you're poor, I'll put on them. That's what the statue of bigotry says. You're poor, huddled masses, let's club them to death. Get it over with and just dump them on the boulevard. Get them out on the dirty boulevard. Going out to the dirty boulevard. They're going down on the dirty boulevard. Going out. Outside, it's a bright night. There's an opera at Lincoln Center. Movie stars arrive by limousine. The Klieg lights shoot up over the skyline of Manhattan.